Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We have, over these last couple of days, turned our attention to an accurate and complete translation of Numbers, which is Bamidbar in the wilderness in Hebrew. The sixth chapter, beginning right around the 22nd verse, although understand there are no chapters and verses in the Torah or any place in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. They were added many thousands of years after they were written by religious institutions. Do you think there's a reason, perhaps, that Yahweh did not scribe his Torah, prophets, and Psalms with the chapter and verse notations, Kirk?
Well, it is easier to mess them up if you do it that way.
And why is it easier to mess it up if you put chapter and verse designations?
Well, you can organize the thoughts accordingly and break thoughts up. And, you know, a lot of times things become out of context when you do that as well.
That's correct. A Christian will believe, as a Muslim does with their Quran, that a person is not citing quoting something correctly. They will view a correct quotation if you cite an entire verse. Mm-hmm. And they will say, well, that's, you know, that. And by the way, they typically don't. They typically take something out of a verse, like Quran 5:32, you know, where they say if a person kills one person, it's as if they killed all humanity, to show that the Quran is and Islam is peaceful, when in fact they removed the beginning of the verse where they said, we mandated for the people of the book, the Jews, mm-hmm. that if they kill one person, it's as if they killed all humanity. It's a rule for the Jews, not a rule for the Muslims. And they take it out of the context of the verse that follows, which says that the penalty for those who wage war against Muslims and those who are in opposition to Islam is that they be murdered, crucified, and mutilated.
And they...
So they just take it out of context to create a misimpression. It's what Paul did to create the his gospel of grace, was to take Yahweh's statements out of context. And so this notion of having chapter and verses gives people the idea that they can cite something as a chapter and verse and having conveyed its meaning when, as we found out with our three-week review of Yohanan 3:16, mm-hmm. that if you take it out of context, you will come up with a meaning that's the antithesis of what was conveyed in context.
Mm-hmm. I've seen the little Bible, the original one that the priest in France broke it down in chapter and verse. That's where it all came from. He's the first one to break them down. But
In fact, there's a guy who was actually riding on horseback when he was doing it, and he was trying to kind of keep attention as to where he was, and he felt that if he added chapter and verses while riding on horseback, it would be easier for him to kind of know where he was. I cite chapter and verse only because I want people to verify the translations that we are providing for themselves.
Sure.
And in so doing, if I provide chapter and verse, they can use a variety of different tools to look up the words that are interlinear and then check the words in a Hebrew English dictionary and verify the translations. That's the only reason I reference them. But you're right. Chapter and verses are a very bad idea because they take something out of context. And when you do that, you come to the wrong conclusion. One of my favorite for out of context happens to be Yirmiyah 31. Christians will cite part of one statement, part of one verse in Yirmiyah 31 to justify their New Testament. Mm-hmm. And they will say that there was the announcement of the new covenant, and it says that the new covenant will be different than the existing covenant. And that's a mistranslation out of context.
Right.
And in context, it says that that this will be not for Gentiles and not for a church, but for Yisrael and Yehuda, which means this replacement theology of Christianity has torn asunder. And this is not for the Christian church or for Gentiles. It's for Jews and Israel, Yisrael and Yehuda.
Mm-hmm.
First of all. And second of all, it says the only difference between the existing covenant and the renewed covenant, the renewal of that covenant, is that the Torah is going to be integrated into our very nature and that Yahweh is going to write it on our hearts.
Yeah. That's quite the same, is it?
Yes. You put it in context, and it rather than supporting and justifying a Christian New Testament, it completely annuls any possibility of there being a Christian New Testament.
Well, I notice here that even in this section that we're going over, you start where we started at 6:24, but you started at 6:22 because
yes.
If you don't have 6:22, then you miss the point.
Correct.
So I mean that's a case in point there. So.
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, let's just read it up to this point, and then I'll have we'll say what Yahweh said next, and then we'll also compare it to the King James version of it. So 6:22 says, "And Yahweh, he elected to speak the eternal word to influence Moshe, to approach by saying, speak to prompt a decision to Aaron and to his sons, to draw near by communicating this demonstrative frame of reference. You should always bless, benefiting by lifting up in love, positively and eternally influencing accordingly, the children of Yisrael," which means individuals who engage and endure with God, who strive and contend with God, who are empowered by and preserved by God, who exert themselves on behalf of and persist with God, by literally saying to them, so the way that you're going to eternally and positively benefit the children of Yisrael is to say the following things to them. Now, that's rather important context, don't you think?
Mm-hmm, very much so.
And that Aaron was going to lift up and positively benefit the children of Israel by saying the following things. And here's the first line, and then we will compare it to the King James here in a moment. It says, Yahweh. Doesn't say the Lord. It says Yahweh.
Yahweh.
He wants to kneel down in love, to continually bless you, desiring to lift you up forever for your benefit. And he has decided to actually and continually focus upon you. Now, what is the King James?
It says, the Lord bless thee and keep thee.
My God. First of all, the Lord, who's that? I mean, Yahweh uses the Hebrew term for Lord, Baal, throughout the Torah.
That's
to describe one individual. Who is that individual?
Satan, Satan.
Yeah,
yes,
the adversary.
Adversary.
So if you're saying the Lord bless thee, you're talking about Satan.
Yeah, you want to hear a couple other verses? I mean, the
sure.
same verse in a couple other ways. The American
sure.
Standard Version is Jehovah bless thee. There's the...
Jehovah. Is there any even no remote possibility
not even
that God's name could be Jehovah?
No, that's not.
Is there a J in Hebrew?
No, sir.
Is there a J sound in Hebrew?
No, sir. No V either.
Is there no V in Hebrew, is there?
No, they try to put one in there now, but there wasn't one. There was never one up till currently.
Yeah, so what happened to the Y? What happened to the H?
Yeah.
They get the sound of the W, but eliminate it
mm-hmm.
by replacing the letter that creates the O sound with a V.
Mm-hmm.
They at least got the "ah" at the end of it, correct? But, you know, it's God's name, you know. You think that God knows how to spell. I mean, I'm just going to just ask a wild question out there. The author of DNA, that is a multidimensional, intertwined alphabet, that is the basis for life, that programs life. Do you think that the God who conceived DNA as the language of life would be capable of spelling his own name and his own revelation in a language that he himself also conceived?
You would think he would know how to do that. I think that's a good assumption. Yeah.
Yeah, and the fact that he spelled his name 7,000 times and always spelled it the same way, would you say that, you know, maybe that's the way that it should be spelled and therefore pronounced?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's Yahweh, folks. So this is Yahweh. As you know, Kirk, it's Yahweh's outstretched arm with an open hand. So the first letter, the Yod in Yahweh's name, and this is, by the way, when Yosha said not a single jot and tittle, he was actually saying Yod in Hebrew. It's the first letter of Yahweh's name. It depicts the very thing that he is doing here. You know, getting down to lift us up. He's reaching down and out with an open hand to lift us up. That's the first letter of his name.
Right.
And there's two people standing in his name, right?
Right. Uh-huh.
One is Abraham. The other is Sarah, mother and father of the covenant.
Standing, reaching up.
Yeah. By the way, what was the first child of the covenant? What was his name?
Yishak.
What does it mean?
It means laughter. Fun time.
Do you think that might define the purpose of the Yahweh's covenant family?
You would think it's supposed to be a happy thing.
Not a miserable thing. Yeah, well, you sure think so. And when God says, I want you to call him Yishak Laughter, uh-huh. Would you suppose that the creator of the universe has a sense of humor?
He does.
Yeah.
Sounds like a fun guy to be around, don't you?
Yes, it sounds that way to me. So there's two hays in his name, and between these two hays, which are people standing up, not mm-hmm. kneeling. So Yahweh is the one kneeling down, and in his name, we're the ones standing up.
Standing up.
That's pretty, it's the antithesis of religion, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, the absolute opposite perspective is religion. And in between them is the Hebrew wall, which means to increase. It is to enlarge and secure a home.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the home he's talking about is the covenant home, his family.
Right, the family and the family home. Right. The family.
Yeah. What does Yahweh say about his name when he introduces himself to Moshe?
He says it's Haya.
That he exists is based upon Haya, that's right, which is the Hebrew word for I was, I am, and I will be, written in the first person as he wrote it, Ihaya. But didn't he also say that Yahweh is my name, and it's the only name?
Only name, yeah.
And the only way I ever want to be remembered and recalled is as Yahweh?
Right.
You think he was telling the truth?
Oh, yeah.
Welcome back to Shattering Myths. So, the most popular English translation, the one created initially in 1609, I believe, most likely by the lead translator, Sir Francis Bacon, who was a Rosicrucian, which means he was an occultist. On behalf of King Iams, as he was known at the time, strictly for political reasons. They didn't do it because they wanted people to know the truth. They didn't know it because they were doing something they thought was a service to humanity. They didn't like the Geneva Bible because the Geneva Bible pointed out that God does not authorize kings.
So the
Geneva Bible says that God does not authorize kings. It became very popular. The King James was created expressly to undermine the influence of the Geneva Bible and to create the impression that God authorizes kings, which is necessary for a king to rule over subjects. And in that Bible, rather than saying Yahweh, and it's Yod-Heh-Wah-Heh, they replaced Yahweh with the Lord. Mm-hmm. Is there any place that you will read Yahweh calling himself Ha-Baal?
No.
How about even Ha-Adon?
No, that is my Lord.
Actually, Adonai is my Lord. Adonai is what the Masoretes wrote above Yahweh, because they, being religious and having usurped Yahweh's authority in rabbinic Judaism, kind of cleverly, you know, they said that, God is clearly, they called him Hashem, the name. Hashem is clearly in favor of free will. And so in free will, the governing influence in free will is a vote. So on establishing religious authority, we will have Hashem vote, and the rabbis will vote, and whoever is in the majority will carry the vote. That was Rabbi Akiva's.
By the way, they're on a railroad, huh?
Yeah, that's Rabbi Akiva's strategy. And they're the ones that came up with my Lord as the replacement for Yahweh's name. Did God give us the authority to replace his name?
I think he gave us the, he told us absolutely the opposite. In fact, this morning when I woke up, I wrote down the three little things that I thought you might add somewhere down the road when we got to the next part about when mm-hmm. we got to his name. And if I recall, paraphrasing a little bit, he said, don't diminish my name. That was in stone.
He rested in stone. That was the third statement on the first of the two tablets. In fact, he even said that the diminishment of my name, which would be the replacement of his name with the Lord, would be the maximum diminishment you could possibly do of his name. Ignoring his name, obliterating it, and replacing it with Satan's title. He says it's an unforgivable sin.
Unforgivable. And he said, my name is, and he called it his renown, and he wants it to be remembered. He wants to be remembered that by that name forever.
Right. yeah, did he ever say you can, but you know, when the Christians come, you can change my name to Jesus Christ?
Sure.
Yeah, right.
Well, and then, then you've got another well-known verse where he says, what is my name and what is my son's name? In Proverbs, I mean.
Yeah, Do you know it?
And then when you throw in the fact that he wrote it 7,000 times, they erased it a couple hundred times and scratched it out 6,800 times.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have a case here.
Yeah, 6,832, that you'll find it in the Masoretic text. And in the Dead Sea Scrolls, we find 138 times where it is written that was completely erased from the Masoretic text. You add those two together, and you get exactly 7,000. I mean, 7,000 times, it staggers the mind that religious morons would take it upon themselves to justify erasing his name and replacing it with Satan's title 7,000 times. It doesn't say, ha Baal here. It doesn't say, ha Adon here. It says Yahweh here. What right does man have to change God's testimony and then hold it up and say this is the inerrant word of God when they knowingly and deliberately have changed it? You know, in the New American Standard, every Bible has, if you read the preface to it, they'll all explain how they did this.
Mm-hmm.
And the New American Standard, they say, you know, there's no religious credibility to, there's no respect for, no merit in Yahweh's name, so... We took it upon ourselves to change it to the Lord. And every place you read the Lord, in the text you'll find Yod Heh Vav Heh. Doing it deliberately. Knowingly, deliberately, deceiving. That's like going into DNA and saying, you know, I think I'm going to erase about half of it here. And let's see how it works. Plan justifies their New Testament, where Yahweh actually completely undermines any possibility of a New Testament. It's a book that is the only book of its kind in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms that actually says that it was written on behalf of and to Gentiles. In that book, which is a conversation against the influence of religion, Yahweh says the single greatest crime that's ever been perpetrated was the replacement of his name with the title the Lord. So God's pretty upset about this.
Mm-hmm.
He calls it the single greatest crime that's ever been perpetrated is this crime that is perpetrated by every religious publication, the substitution of his name for Satan's title the Lord. But it gets worse as we go forward. You might say that, well, since Barak does convey blessing, although that's not his primary meaning. His primary meaning is to kneel down. And it's to kneel down to lift up. So it's not bowing down. There's a Hebrew word for bowing down. It's not to bow down. It's to kneel down with the express purpose of lifting up.
A lot different.
Yeah, a lot different. The... they only conveyed one word for Barak. They omitted his primary meaning, which is to kneel down. They ignored the secondary meaning, which is to lift up. And they chose its tertiary meaning, which is to bless. And then what they forgot is the juice of mood. Do you think that Yah created the juice of mood, which is an expression of third-person volition? Do you think he created the juice of mood and added the suffix letter to the verb bless, to kneel down, to lift up in love? Do you think he added the juice of mood just because he says, ha-ha, this will make it more challenging and they'll never figure this out and hopefully they'll just ignore it?
Hardly.
Hardly. The juice of mood is an expression of third-person volition. Volition can be conveyed in English in one of two ways. You can express it as the will or desire of the individual, or you can express it as the choice or decision of an individual. Now, those things are usually very related, and, you know, if I want to lift up my child, I will decide to lift up my child. You know, they usually aren't in conflict. These are related concepts, but they can be expressed either one of the two ways. It's either Yahweh has chosen to kneel down in love, Yahweh wants to kneel down in love, it's Yahweh's will to kneel down in love, Yahweh's decided to kneel down in love. But it's an expression of his will. Why did they leave it out?
Maybe just make him too nice a guy. I mean, who knows?
Yeah. Now, this was also written in the imperfect. There's two conjugations in Hebrew, the perfect and the imperfect. If it's written in the imperfect, it means?
Continually.
Continually.
Ongoing.
Why did they leave that out?
Once again, I could give you a lot of motives, but it's just changed everything. I mean,
but, you know, but Paul told us that that God of the Old Testament in his Torah are mean-spirited and that they enslave and that they can't possibly save. How could this be a continuous act and this God's desire to constantly get down on his knees to lift us up and to do it on an ongoing basis forever, if that were true?
It's very much written in the way that a king of England would want you to approach him. I might decide to bless you, you know.
Yeah, I might. Yeah.
Keep bowing to me, keep doing what I
right.
say, you know. Anyway,
yeah.
I might be nice to you.
But yeah, of course, it's written as this would be the king getting on his knees to lift up his subjects.
Yeah, hardly. Hardly.
And doing it because he wants to, and doing it all the time.
Yes, continuously.
Yeah. All right, so he wants to kneel down in love, continually blessing you, desiring to lift you up forever for your benefit. Because before your benefit, there's another aspect of this. There's a stem that establishes a relationship between the subject and object. There's three modifiers to this verb. The King James eliminated all three. Now, part of the reason they eliminated all three is the King James is not a translation of the Hebrew. There wasn't a single Hebrew scholar on the King James team. Francis Bacon did not know Hebrew, and they had no Hebrew manuscript. The only credible Masoretic manuscript is the Codex Leningradus. It wasn't even found until the 19th century, and it wasn't published until the 20th century. So there is no understanding whatsoever of Hebrew, and so they were translating the Latin and probably even had no knowledge of any of this. But now that we have the Dead Sea Scrolls, which date to, in the case of the Torah here, date, you know, back into the 2nd century BCE. Mm-hmm. And we have a 11th century Masoretic text. Mm-hmm. Why haven't subsequent translations, of which there have been scores of them?
Mm-hmm.
Why don't they correct?
Is it? Yeah.
Right.
They just don't do it.
These mistakes. Yeah, so this was written in the Peel stem. The Peel stem says that the subject, who is Yahweh, influences the object, which is you and me. So they chose not to convey that him getting down on his knees actually influences us by lifting us up.
Right.
Which is why we're shown standing, by the way, in his name. And so they got a single word and they forgot all of the relational impact of the stem, the ongoing nature of the conjugation, volitional nature of the mood, and they eliminated the primary and secondary meaning of Barak. Would you like to share with our listeners again, you've done this before, but what are the three letters that comprise Barak? What do they tell us about this word?
They're the B-R and the K, which is the Bet, the Rosh, and the Kaf. And, of course, the Bet is the family home, picture of a family home. The mm-hmm. R comes from Rosh, the Rosh letter Rosh, and it is a head that is observant mm-hmm. through hearing, through seeing, through thinking, and responding. And the Kaf is, of course, the open hand where you would greet someone. So it's a totally different connotation.
And since it's the observant individual who is part of his family and home that he's reaching out to and opening the way to and greeting with his open hand, who is he kneeling down to? All of humanity?
No, those who are considering, observing him.
Right. And who are part of his family.
Part of his family, right.
The only people he saves, the only people he communicates to, the only people he talks to, the only people he listens to.
He's not going to bring everybody into the party to mess up the party.
That's right. Now, there is an exception to that, and it's a temporary exception, and it's in rare cases. It's probably fewer times than one in a million.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that Yahweh will reach out to, and he will communicate with someone
yeah.
who he knows because he has seen the future. Will choose to engage in a relationship with him. Will choose to pay attention to what he has to say. Will then choose to accept and act upon the terms and conditions of the covenant. And before they do, he will reach out to them.
Mm-hmm.
He did it with Abraham. He did it with Dode. He did it with me. He's done it with you. He will reach out to those who he knows he wants to spend eternity to, and that he knows will choose of their own free will to be observant and be part of his family. And he'll introduce himself. Moshe was a great example.
If you were hanging out with the crowd and you were not of the 10 or the 12 tribes and you were part of going along with Moshe and all those, you're in close proximity to these people, then the invitation is to you too. I mean, it's not like you had to be part of the
correct.
Chosen people.
Oh, yeah. The invitation is to everyone. The invitation is to everyone. And it's an open invitation. He wrote it in his Torah, the most publicized book in human history.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's not like it's no one has a chance. I mean, it's there.
No. Everybody has the opportunity to get to know Yahweh, and anybody can read the Torah. It's his open invitation to engage in this family and this relationship. You're right. That said, the exception to the rule of God never talks to or listens to anyone who isn't part of his family is for a very brief period of time, certain individuals he will reach out to and talk to and introduce himself to before they have come to know him and before they've chosen to become part of his family. But in 100% of those cases, those individuals choose to be observant and choose to engage in his family. Now, the next word is the one that they have, and keep thee. But the word is shamar. Shamar doesn't mean keep.
No, it's very much observe.
Yeah, it's observe.
Carefully consider, pay close attention to.
Yeah, wouldn't you like the creator of the universe, who has so much to give, who is willing to get down on his knees to lift us up, wouldn't you want him to pay attention to you, to be interested in you, to focus on you, to consider your merit?
Mm-hmm. Is there any child that didn't want their parent to pay attention to them?
Of course not. And when you're a parent and you're paying attention to your child, it's both benefit, the parent and the child. And that's what shamar means. Why don't we dissect shamar through the three letters that comprise the word?
We have the starts out with the shin, which is an SH sound. It's in the shape of teeth. It's language, nourishment. The next letter is the mem, which is an M, and that's water, life. This last letter, the
cleansing.
Yes, I'm sorry, and cleansing. Connotation there with the set apart spirit, the Ruach Kodesh, that cleanses us. The Rosh, the R, which is once again we're engaged. It's the engaged individual, the one who's carefully considering.
Yeah, eyes are being used to read, ears are being used to listen, mouth being used to respond, brain being used to process that information. So you would absolutely expect that in a word that means to observe, that to closely examine and carefully consider, you would have the Rosh in the midst of it, which is an observant individual. And that's the word concludes with that. But it tells us what we ought to be observing,
right,
with the shin, which is the word, and the mem, which is the inspiration, the enlightenment that comes from the word and its life-renewing and cleansing nature. So, Kirk, we have really inverted this when we say, I have the Lord keeping me.
Right.
That's having Satan keep control over someone.
Pretty much is the way you can
keep them is to restrict them, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I'm going to keep you here. I'm going to keep you, you know, under control, under my watchful eye. Now, there is a distant derivative of keep in shamar. That's to keep focused on.
And protective, in a protective
right. sense. Right, in a protective way. So that, mm-hmm. you know, as a parent, if you keep focused on your children, you're more likely to protect them from harm.
Sure. I'm sorry.
But that's a derivative of paying attention and considering them, right?
Absolutely. That's paying close attention. I mean, you watch your kid. Yes. Let me throw in two little quick thoughts, and I know it'll change the flow a little bit, but not only do they change all the words and the meanings.
Right.
Even though Yahusha said, don't change the jot and the tittle, I mean, they threw away an entire alphabet.
Yeah, they did.
I mean, that's a little more than a jot and a tittle.
Yeah.
But
yeah, he said, don't change a single yod, which was the change to jot. Who knows why they changed it to jot, but it's a yod. It's the smallest letter in Hebrew. It's the first letter of Yahweh's name. And the tittles are the strokes that comprise the Hebrew letters. He says, don't change a single one of those.
Yeah,
and you're right. They threw out the entire alphabet.
Now, Terry came up with this yesterday when I went downstairs, and she was listening to the show downstairs, and that's my wife, by the way, and she said to me, you know, I was thinking about the space probe, and I said, okay, and the space probe, when they sent out letters, symbolic letters, to communicate with the great unknown. I mean, y'all did that pretty good to begin with.
Yeah, the Voyager space probe is the only probe ever to leave our solar system. It has a plaque on it that uses symbols and letters to describe where it came from and who we are.
So they agree that that's probably the best way to communicate.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
So my point is, smart people,
yes.
why do you poo-poo this language?
Yeah. You know, words which are comprised of letters and can be are both as written symbols and verbal sounds, that words are the basis of relationship. If you and your wife, Terry, stopped talking, you would have no relationship. If you didn't begin your relationship by talking, you'd have no relationship. If you are thinking, like she was thinking and then communicating those thoughts to you.
Right.
She was thinking in words. And then she communicated the idea in words. Without words, we have no ability to learn, no ability to think, no ability to communicate, no ability to engage in relationships, no ability to grow. Words are the food of the mind and the soul for us to grow, to learn, to be enlightened. There's really nothing more important than words. It's That's why Yahweh says, you know, if you want to see me, look at my words. And you're right. In this case, they threw out the whole alphabet. And, I mean, this is like throwing out DNA.
Yeah.
Being a biologist and say, you know, what I think I'm going to do is just throw out DNA because it's just way too cumbersome. I want to come up with something different. Say what?
Who are these people?
Right. I mean, here's the word, the letters of the word explain the meaning of the word. And yet they threw out all of that so they could change it. So they have the Lord keeping you. Keeping you from what? And when he didn't say, I'm going to keep you, it's the kind of the, and not only is the concept, Kirk, of Yahweh getting on his knees to lift us up in love so that we're standing and he's the one lifting us up, which is the antithesis of religion. This is the most wonderful perspective in the world, Shamar, recognizing that if we pay attention to who Yahweh is, he will pay attention to us. If you want God to care about you, to notice you, to engage with you, to enrich you, to empower you, to save you, pay attention to him. He reciprocates. Mm-hmm. It's ultimately fair, isn't it?
I think it's wonderful. That's something you can do.
Yeah. I mean, personally, I want the creator of the universe, who has the power over life and death, who has the power to perfect and to save, who has the power to teach and to enlighten. I want him to care about me.
Sure.
Yeah.
I think the argument there.
That this is it's the ultimate desire. It's what we should all want. But how are we going to get there if we corrupt all of the words and we toss out the very language that communicates us?